Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Anthology of Horror. I'm your host, Spring-Heeled Jack, and today I'm back with the saga of Mr. James Micropenis Jones, the architect of the Jonestown Massacre and founder of the People's Temple Church, if you want to call it that. I started recording today a final episode, and I realized how many just gaping fucking holes I'd left because I was in a rush to just get over the fucking tragic ending of this, and I figured I was doing it a disservice. So this is not going to be a three-parter. Unfortunately, I will continue to break it up with different things because I know listening to the same subject is fucking agonizing, but the story needs to be told, much like the Girl Next Door episodes. And as always, thank you very much for tuning back in, and this may or may not be an ad-free guaranteed experience. I'm not being paid to run the advertisements that I'm running. I just run them to break up the pressuring desire to want to stab yourself in the fucking eardrum so you don't have to hear this terrible story. But I value your time, and I appreciate each and every one of you for tuning back in and for spreading the word. So if this is your first time, thank you for tuning in. And for repeat listeners, I appreciate each and every one of you. You guys have been great. Thank you so much. Right back at it. As always, my source is, for this, Jeff Gwynn's The Road to Jonestown, as well as the recently added FBI files that I found for it. And Raven is another book that I've been using as well.
And now a message from our sponsors. Children out of control? Is it wine o'clock yet? Then why not try out wine goggles? Wine goggles improve the performance of even the most mediocre supermarket Chardonnay or Merlot. Wear them while you drink and make everything look that little bit better. Available from all good opticians and some bad ones too. Warning, this product may not improve your eyesight. Not recommended as part of a calorie-controlled diet. Do not operate heavy machinery while wearing wine goggles.
So up until this point, it's safe to say that Jim Jones has come off as a pretty decent, caring dude. Now, what are two things in your mind that would change most decent, caring dudes into raving lunatic pieces of shit? Well, the two that come to my mind that I've never had any personal experience with, but I've heard of people, horrible sinners, having personal experience with drugs and fucking. The two things that supposedly will make people insane. But as I said, I have no fucking experience with either one of those things, but Jim Jones did. He always had to worry about the next stumble that he couldn't explain sufficiently. Like, if he was supposed to be God and the Messiah, why did he run out of energy and shit? He understood that once any significant erosion of belief in him occurred, it would only escalate and turn into a mob mentality of the faithless. The obvious way to avoid failure was to stop trying to do more. People's Temple was already unqualified in its success, and its membership was quite impressive. Its mission, admirable, and its outreach programs, effective. A substantial number of needy people had been and were being helped to have better lives. Though members were taught that personal pride was wrong, they could still justly feel proud of their church and its accomplishments. And they were grateful to a man who made it possible that they could overlook an occasional infrequent stumble on his part because he did so fucking much for everybody. All he needed to do was settle for what he and the People's Temple already had. But young Jimba never accepted limitations. It was stemmed from his mother, who was sporadic at best, but in her attempts at parenting, regaled him with tales of vision and reincarnation and how he was preordained to do great things. And even when Jones was an adult, Lynetta hammered home that he was special from birth. If her son was father, then she glorified in her self-assumed role as temple grandmother to anyone who was willing to listen, and often to those that weren't. Lynetta repeated the tale of her initial vision and that she would give birth to a godlike son, and related wildly fanciful stories about how everyone back in Lynn, Indiana, came to little Jimba for comfort and counsel. to hear his piece of shit mother tell it, Jesus Christ, was, it, God damn it. To hear Lynetta tell it, her child's emergence as a unique spiritual leader was only possible through careful nurturing of her. So she took to writing and reciting poems about it that I'm not going to read because fuck you. But you can find them online, and they're terrible. Pretty much a blatant Edgar Allan Poe ripoff. You get the last paragraph. I came again when years were gone, and it was a man I looked upon with such godlike nature bore that the men could change it nevermore. And it's not much better for the rest of it. So eat shit. You're never going to be Edgar Allan Poe. And although Edgar Allan Poe died stuttering and drunk in a fucking gutter, he's still a better guy than Jim Jones. It's impossible to be certain whether Jimba truly believed that he was God or that he was the spirit of Jesus that reappeared once every generation. But what's inarguable is that he felt himself to be something beyond an ordinary man. And there was special divinity in him. Much of his healing stagecraft was manufactured, but sometimes he would muse that perhaps the occasionally cripples did walk or cancers were cured because the afflicted believed in him. And so he did wield a form of healing power, potentially, in his own mind. And when Jones alternated descriptions of his godliness from sermon to sermon, sometimes in the same sermon, it was at least in part because even he felt hard-pressed to find something so powerful and vast. I hear you. I understand that. I too suffer a bit of a God complex, and it varies from day to day. And God, or somebody who believed himself to be partially God, did not settle. Every day, the ambition of Jones cranked up a notch, and so inevitably did the pressure that he felt. So because of his leadership style, he could not share the burden with others, because God doesn't share his burden. From his first days of storefront preaching in Indianapolis, Jimba was determined to control every aspect of his ministry. Sometimes he appointed committees and advisory boards, but always gave the impression that he wanted their input. But they invariably went along with whatever he wanted. So they were just, what do they call it? The agreement cycle or fucking echo chamber. As People's Temple grew, a few members gradually formed a small, ever-evolving inner circle, but Jones didn't confide completely in anybody. Survivors agree he led on a need-to-know basis, and Jones was determined to be the only one who knew everything. I think he just made it up as he went, to be perfectly honest. I don't think anyone knew because there wasn't anything to know. Marceline came close, and she alone didn't really have any sense of what he was planning, apart from his ministry. So some familiarity with his quirks and the most effective way to conquer his human feelings, she knew, but that was it. Jones never considered Marceline an equal in the temple, and once he began his relationship with this lady, Carolyn Layton, his wife was relegated to the same compartmentalized role as one of his buddies, Jack Beam, or an Archie James, who was his second. Somebody that would do Jones's bidding rather than share in any significant decision-making. Why is it that side bitches of serial killers are always Carolyn? Carolyn didn't share Jones' most innermost thoughts. Besides fucking, her value to him lay in the supervisory skills to see Jones' edicts carried out. There wasn't anybody associated with Jones in the People's Temple to tell him no and make it stick. Because only Jones understood and oversaw everything, he had to be involved in every detail of every activity, and nothing was insignificant enough to completely delegate. Someone else might script the responses of the temple's phone operators, but Jones had to read and approve each line before it was put into effect. Another member might attend a public meeting to represent the temple, but Jones required a full report after, which key officials had been there, so on and so forth. What attitudes did they seem to have towards the temple and its programs? He needed extreme amounts of detail. And if a member wanted to get married or divorced or even bring an outsider to a temple meeting, Jones had to be consulted first. Not a penny could be spent without his permission. Members sometimes just chaffed at the length of the meetings, but he was there for every minute too. Even to point out discreetly that even relieving himself in a basin behind the pulpit rather than take a shit break. You're fucking gross, dude. On surviving tapes, his sermons sound just frequently incoherent, but careful examination suggests that they were less stream of consciousness than they seemed. Jones realized his appeal differed among his followers, so usually the newest thought he was God, and the other more recent ones wanted affirmation that their belief in the spark of divinity was possible in anybody. Those who'd followed him from Indiana remembered when Jones had never claimed divinity, only dedication to social causes, and loved him for that. Many more followers followed him because of his apparent powers. Most meetings had to include at least a healing or two. Older members, the pensioners whose Social Security and disability checks formed the bedrock of the temple's finances, frequently retained at least some attachment to the Bible. There were agnostics, atheists, and a whole bunch of people in between in the temple, and they were attracted by its social goals and socialist ideals, and by Jones' frequent dismissal of the Bible as racist propaganda. He had to please everybody, and so his sermons deliberately rambled like a fucking lunatic, and like a great composer crafting a multi-movement symphony, Jones varied his rhythm and tone. He ran the gamut from fire and brimstone to social commentator. And at one point, Jones might throw down a Bible and stomp on it, and yet a little later, cite scripture to reinforce some socialist point that he was trying to make. He'd refer to himself as God, the reincarnation of Christ, or Lenin in the single turn at the pulpit. No one listening, even those who were most devoted to him, could take it all in, but at some point, each follower heard something that reaffirmed his or her personal reason for belonging to the People's Temple and for believing in Jim Micropenis Jones. As Jonestown historian Fielding McGehee observes, what you thought Jim said depended on who you were. It was exhausting to sit through a single 3 or 4 hour Saturday service, and on Sundays in Redwood Valley, there were 2, plus additional meetings during the week that frequently lasted well into the night. But it was even more exhausting to conduct the marathons. Hearing Jones' sermon on tape doesn't sufficiently convey the energy he expended in delivering them. He was constantly moving, gesturing broadly from behind the pulpit, marching dramatically around the stage, jumping up and down on the floor to roam the aisles, patting heads, squeezing titties, offering embraces, grabbing asses. Before, between, and after services, he mingled and tried to make as many as possible feel individually noticed by Father Jimba. While everyone else enjoyed Sunday's group potluck meals, Jones usually talked some more on the portable sound system, reminding them to revel in fellowship and afterward prepare for another week of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, so on and so forth, sucking the father's dick. Aside from temple services, when Jones wasn't on constant call in Redwood Valley, he was often in bus number 7 on his way to and from programs where he'd put on dazzling shows for thousands of outsiders. During each drive, he would deal with dozens or even hundreds of separate issues, ranging from which city the advance crew should visit next, to how many hand towels should be purchased for the Redwood Valley Church shitter. Sounds exhausting. There was an additional strain, one never acknowledged by those who think Jones' only motivation was acquiring and wielding power. But even as a child, Jones was genuinely moved by poverty and by race-related suffering. At every stage of its existence, People's Temple outreach programs really did practice what he preached. Needy people were served. Outcasts formed every corner of the community, and they were warmly welcomed. Yet, no matter how many people were fed, clothed, helped to find jobs, or rescued from drug addiction by the temple programs, Jim Jones ached for all those that still were not. He identified with individuals as well as the multitudes. And once, just before the temple's Greyhound convoy left the Redwood Valley parking lot for an out-of-town trip, Jones convened a meeting of a few divisional superiors, or supervisors rather, in bus 7. Outside, several hundred members stowed luggage and climbed aboard the buses. Jones' meeting was very important. He was giving instructions for some program to be implemented while he was away. The trip ahead was a long one, and they needed to get on the road ASAP, but as Jones talked, he frequently glanced out the window, and all at once pointed to an elderly woman struggling with a bulky suitcase. Jones barked, "Some of you motherfuckers get out there! That sister needs our help!" He refused to continue the meeting until the old lady's bag was securely stowed, and she had been escorted to her seat on the bus. He genuinely did want to lift up the oppressed, I believe, and Jones' pace could not slacken. So wherever he went, he saw human suffering, and sometimes his twin motivators, power and ministry, coexisted comfortably. What served one served the other. More often, as the People's Temple expanded, the admirable motive was sublimated in favor of Jones' baser objective. Ultimately, however, personal ambition completely won out. But in 1971, he still struggled to satisfy both, and in doing so, he drove his followers relentlessly and drove himself 10 times harder. This took its inevitable toll. He was physically exhausted, as were his members, and the emotional strain on him was much greater. Caught or not, he became more worn down by each passing day, and by his own design, Jones had made the temple well-being entirely dependent on his own. So this justified his evolving belief that anything he did for himself benefited those who believed in and followed him, as well as all those in desperate need of the temple assistance. No matter how apparently selfish some of his personal actions might appear, nothing was ever really for him, but for them. By 1971, Jones already permitted himself a few personal indulgences that were concealed from most temple followers. Movies were frowned on for rank and file, but in spare weekend hours between meetings, especially when they were held in San Francisco or LA, Jones headed for the cinema. He loved mysteries and action movies. Over the years, he identified his favorites as Chinatown. I was going to make that joke. I didn't realize. And MASH. Didn't realize it was a thing. Jones told the truth when he claimed to only wear hand-me-downs and clothes purchased at discount stores, but he had a fondness for a specific type of black lace-up shoe and thick sole. A thick-soled black lace-up shoe. Like the fucking Navy PT shoes? What the fuck? Oh my god. Wearing New Balance sneakers. These were the only shoes that he wore, but he had six pairs of them. God damn it. Wow. Somebody is squared away. Above all, though, he swore in sermons that he spent every available minute on temple business. He took vacations with his family, often for 1 or 2 weeks at a time. Members were told that Father was away on important business, but these trips, they cost a shitload of money, and Jones received no salary from the temple. Jones lived on Marceline's earnings as a state employee, but Jones controlled the temple bank accounts, and on at least two occasions, he withdrew several $1,000s for personal expenses. It was not embezzlement. The transaction records were logged in the temple files. Still, only Jones and a few discreet associates had access to these files, and he certainly preferred for the general temple's membership not to know about his little indulgences. Eventually, such minor pleasures weren't sufficient to offset the growing pressure that he was feeling, and probably in 1971, he began turning regularly to a source of greater relief. He was influenced this time not by his mother, but by his father. After being gassed in World War I, Big Jim never passed a comfortable day and deflected his physical and mental distress with pills supplied to him during treatments at his regional VA hospital. 40 years later, Jim Jones emulated his dad for once. As far back as 65, Gary Lambert remembers Jones occasionally pausing in mid-sermon to complain about how he needed to use his pain medicine. Jones said that he didn't like doing it, but he sometimes needed the pills to alleviate discomfort from various unspecified ailments. Temple membership was then less than 100, and most had come west from Indiana with Jones. They knew him well and harbored no belief that he was God above human and that he needed occasional self-medication, and that was fine. As the temple grew, Jones' reference to personal use of pain pills completely stopped. Whether he'd actually discontinued them or not was up for speculation, and his expanding ranks of more worshipful members couldn't be allowed to think that Father needed drugs to function, especially since he forbade them to his followers. It would have been a contradiction that even Jones could not explain away. And sometimes around 71, he began abusing drugs on a daily basis. Amphetamines, to wake up in the morning and get going, and tranquilizers, to sleep at night, which is a vicious cycle, pills and liquid to provide energy boosts and slow himself down enough to rest. If you've ever seen anybody on that vicious cycle, it is fucking disgusting. Up in the morning, groggy as fuck, red eyes, your eyes are redder than the devil's dick, your wiener will never work again, and then pills to sleep at night, and you sleep until you fucking die in your sleep because you're not going to wake up for anything. You're sleeping at least until you piss yourself. Access to these drugs was not a problem. There were physicians sympathetic to the temple that would write prescriptions for fucking anything to Jones or else to his followers, as long as they were sworn to secrecy as they passed the medication along to Father. Jones didn't have to depend entirely on prescriptions either. Temple membership worked as nurses and aides in numerous hospitals and care facilities. It was an era where records were kept on the honor system and by hand, and it was relatively simple to smuggle out whatever Jones wanted. He stressed that these suppliers, that they were serving the People's Temple in a very special and private way. To great extent, he was able to disguise his mood swings that were inevitable from this drug cycle to the general congregation as just his fucking... He was able to disguise them for the most part. He almost made it so that they weren't witnessing it so much. When he was out on the road, he could self-medicate in his private quarters above bus 7, acquiring chemically enhanced stamina for his public appearances, and then drugging himself to sleep as the temple caravan headed back to Redwood Valley and all the demands that awaited him there. To anyone that knows what drug abuse looks like, it was painfully obvious. But some, a frequent sharp temper, they weren't necessarily going to identify him as a drug user. Father had always been impatient, and the drug certainly didn't help. A more obvious side effect was the red, watery eyes, like I said. And Jones, who sometimes wore dark glasses, now began wearing them every fucking day. You know, there was a time I had a fuckload of friends die in 2016. To the point that I was just... Well, you know, fuck it. I still do. I still wear sunglasses all the time inside because it's a sign in people's life. And people are wearing sunglasses inside all the time. Something is wrong. And for Jimba, it was not all his friends dying. It was drugs. But he claimed it was because his inner powers were so great that holy energy often glowed out of his eyes like fucking Cyclops Jesus. Followers looked directly at him, and if they saw his eyes, they might be scorched by the power of divinity. Oh, for fuck's sake. The most harmful side effect, as with most users of stimulants will tell you, is the paranoia. It's a typical side effect of amphetamine abuse for some, much like the shadow people and fucking voices are for others. Jones had already assumed there were individuals and entities to get him and taught his followers to believe the same, but now he might actually thoroughly believe it, and now his delusions were becoming far more grandiose. FBI, CIA infiltrators, so on and so forth. They were causing internal temple dissension. And it was during this time period that Jones decided to arm his bodyguards. Everybody carrying a gun, first, was required to qualify for appropriate permits, because Jones was not going to have members charged with unlawful possession of a firearm. So now, when the Temple Greyhound convoy was on the road, a few guns were stored in bus 7 just in case, and on some occasion, the bodyguards also wore goon squad uniforms, which were matching shirts, pants, ties, and, much like the Irish Republican Army, berets and aviators. Their appearance was intended to impress the rest of the followers, as much as it was to intimidate outside attack. Their presence was proof that he had his mind made up and was determined to protect them, the followers. The guards and the less militaristic security teams prowling the Redwood Valley Church, local temple-owned buildings at night, noticed, but did not mention to others, significant changes in his personal behavior. Literally, drugs fucking ruined everything for him. Unless he was out of town, he could routinely be found working in his office well past midnight, and sometimes all night. Occasionally, emerging to offer encouraging words to members who were also up late attending the temple's tasks, or else to chide perceived malingerers, and to shame them with his own self-sacrificing example. And now, most nights, sentries posted outside his closed office door heard loud, wet snoring, and Father, after bursting with superhuman energy all through the day, was now sleeping soundly, if noisily, for much of the night, and they had no idea why. Because of fucking drugs, brother. Drugs are a hell of a drug, man. And now, a word from our sponsor. Just kidding. Nobody sponsors me.
If you're dumb enough to buy a new car this weekend,
you're a big enough schmuck to come to Big Bill Hell's Car.
Bad deal.
Cars that break down.
Thieves.
If you think you're going to find a bargain at Big Bill,
you can kiss my ass.
It's our belief that you're such a stupid motherfucker,
you'll fall for this bullshit.
Guaranteed.
If you find a better deal,
shove it up your ugly ass.
You heard us right.
Shove it up your ugly ass.
Bring your tray.
Bring your title.
Bring your wife.
We'll fuck her.
That's right. We'll fuck your wife.
Because at Big Bill Hell,
you're fucked 6 ways from Sunday.
Take a hike
to Big Bill Hell.
Home of challenge pissing.
That's right.
challenge pissing.
How does it work?
If you can piss 6 feet in the air straight up and not get wet,
you get no down payment.
Don't wait.
Don't delay.
Don't fuck with us or we'll rip your nuts off.
Only at Big Bill Hell.
The only dealer that tells you to fuck off.
Hurry up, asshole.
This event ends the minute after you write us a check.
And it better not bounce or you're a dead motherfucker.
Go to hell.
Big Bill Hell's card.
Baltimore's filthiest.
And exclusive home of the meanest sons of bitches in the state of Maryland.
Guaranteed.
Sounds like they're on some of the same shit as old Jimba. Jones had also always been frank and open about fucking, to a point. He always discussed jerking off in intercourse as a teenager, making it clear that they were natural rather than obscene subjects. And he continued that teaching to the youth of the People's Temple. Marceline's 10-year-old cousin, Ronnie, received detailed facts of life lectures from Uncle Jim when he lived with them for a while at the Joneses. And he wowed his elementary school pals, as you remember, with his knowledge of fucking, which nowadays would be a well-earned child services call, but it was not at the time. When Marceline could no longer engage in sex, Jones told his children that was why he took Carolyn Layton as a lover. As pastor of People's Temple, Jones insisted on being familiar with all aspects of his followers' sex lives and telling them that they should and shouldn't sleep with, what members they should and shouldn't sleep with. He generally stopped short of forbidding anybody to have sex, but he couldn't completely regulate it. Former Temple member Tim Carter recalls that people were gonna do it, but he tried to at least make it as difficult as possible, and it was one more way for him to control them. Still, among the members of People's Temple, there was a certain prissiness about sex. In 72 and 73, the pornographic film Deep Throat became a national sensation, and its star, Linda Lovelace, was, for a time, one of the most famous women in America. Linda Amis, one of Jones' most devoted followers, was so humiliated by the X-rated notoriety of the actress that she insisted on being called Sharon, her middle name, rather than share a first name with Lovelace. Jones himself, for all his frequent references and sermons to the human sex drive, sometimes including his own, rarely engaged in public displays of affection with his wife. And one reason most members never guessed his relationship with Carolyn Layton was because he never touched her in public either, except for his oft-told tale of having intercourse with an ambassador's wife in Brazil in return for the generous donation to an orphanage. So far as most People's Temple members were concerned, the only evidence that father's actual sex life existed was his one biological son, Steven. And about the same time he started abusing drugs, Jones began sexually indulging himself beyond old Carolyn Layton. In many ways, his relationship with Carolyn took on aspects of marriage, including a gradual lessening of intimacy, and Jones considered himself above reproach. And the only constraint on him was his own sense of self-control, and with every passing day and increasing drug use, it diminished. 2 years earlier, because of Marceline's physical problems, he'd needed a different source of sex and limited himself to a single new partner. This time, Jones didn't replace Carolyn. He began having sex with others. Essentially, Carolyn became his new senior bitch in his ever-evolving harem. For her and for those followers who formed the innermost temple circle, there was nothing discreet about it. Jones picked out who he wanted to bone among members, took them, and afterwards bragged about it in locker room style with his buddies, like his second man, James, and his other buddy, Beam. Carolyn was hurt and quite mad, but Jones didn't give a shit and didn't consider her feelings to be critical. He believed that he needed more sex than with a variety of partners, as stimulants often make you feel that way, I'm told. It would be good for him and therefore good for the temple, and as he had with Marceline, Jones correctly guessed that Carolyn would reluctantly acquiesce. She still had her turns in Jones's bed and an important place in temple operations. What more could she want? If Carolyn resented Jones' infidelity, that was her fucking problem and not his, goddammit, because he was God and he could fuck whoever he wanted. Goddammit. He's a piece of shit. His quandary was whom to pursue first. That was the biggest struggle that he experienced when it came to fucking. For now, at least. We'll get into some of his other fucking issues. Since Father discouraged even passing friendship with outsiders, Jones could hardly risk consummations beyond the church. But having never tested these impulsive sexual waters, Jones wasn't prepared to force himself indiscriminately on female followers. he would have been hard-pressed to explain away complaints about unwanted advances to their husbands, so he began with safe targets. Besides total belief in and devotion to Jim Jones, Karen Layton was Larry Layton's second wife, who had the additional advantage of being one of the most attractive young women in the temple. I would say disadvantage at this point. When he took Carolyn away from Layton, Jones helped persuade Karen to take Carolyn's place as Layton's spouse. She was an attractive consolation prize, and it helped bolster Layton's bruised ego that so many other men in the temple envied him and his new, much prettier wife. But Karen's primary allegiance was to Jones, and he took her also as a lover in 71. Jesus Christ. It was both a satisfying and a safe move on Jones' part, but Karen's own devotion to him, beyond her own devotion to him, she gladly gave herself to Father, so there was no risk of repercussions there. And Jones also knew there wouldn't be any protesting, at least overtly, from her pussy husband by the name of Larry. Larry was completely under his control, and Carolyn initially found some solace in believing that the attraction was once sighted on Karen's part, and wrote to her parents that Karen had stated repeatedly that she is very much in love with Jim. But Jim made it absolutely clear that he was love-struck with the young woman that married her ex-husband. Jesus Christ. Nothing will ever be reciprocated by him at this level, Carolyn wrote. And Larry Layton had a homosexual crush on Jones, and that's why he allowed it to happen. And that was one of the reasons she divorced him. There's no evidence that this was true, though. By the time that Carolyn realized that Jones was equally attracted to Karen, it was far too late. And while her brief affair with Jones lasted, Karen took pride in their relationship and father, and the fact that the father wanted and needed her. His second man, James, tried tactfully to warn him to keep his sex life completely private by saying, "Brother Jones, I think you trust people too much." Fucking perceptive, sir. Once his desire for Karen was satisfied, Jones moved on to other temple women. His sexual self-image bloomed to a point where he believed that all women, regardless of age and whether they wanted to admit it or not, were attracted to him, which resulted in a subtle but significant change in the way he asked females to take on particularly different tasks. His encouragement of men remained the same. "You've got qualities we need to get this accomplished," but now he told women, "You should do this because you love me." Jones began engaging in episodic sex, typified by a whim rather than even short-term seduction. Consciously or not, he restricted himself to young women, either securely in his personal thrall or else so uncertain to themselves that they would feel overwhelmed and submit. As most insecure or tiny-dicked dudes tend to do, they go substantially younger, so they can just manipulate these younger girls to the point of being malleable. It doesn't amuse me because I fucking hate people, but it's younger women that I've had as friends that have older dudes chasing after them never take my advice of there is something psychologically fucking wrong with this guy, stay away from him, until it's far too late. But it usually pans out to be the case. There is what's legal and then there is what's moral. And just because 18 is the age of consent doesn't mean that it's morally right for a 50-year-old to try to fuck an 18-year-old. My personal opinion. Eventually, almost all the women in... Almost all the women in Jones's inner circle became his occasional conquest. They either considered it part of their duties and their contribution to the cause, or else an honor bestowed on them for distinguished service. Jones always insisted he was doing it for them as well as for himself. They needed sex with the father as it was good for their self-esteem. Feel the pinch for every inch. All two of them. In almost every case, Jones's advances took them by surprise. A lady named Terry Buford was working in an adjacent office during a temple service when Jones came into the room during a lull while the collection plate was being passed around and asked her, "Who are you attracted to?" And Buford, caught off guard, mentioned a few temple men. Jones sounded offended and said, "You're not attracted to me." Buford said she never thought about him that way. He pressed, and soon they fucked. Reflecting, decades later, she said that it wasn't anything special besides the fact that it involved him. It didn't even cross her mind to resist because it was the father, after all. Debbie Layton's account in her memoir, Seductive Poison, indicates that, at least with her, Jones crossed the line into rape. Layton, then was 19, was invited by Jones to ride with him in his private bus compartment on a drive back to the Redwood Valley from San Francisco. She was shocked when he told her to unbutton her shirt and mumbled, "I'm doing this for you to help you, child." Still clothed, pants open just enough, Jones pushed her onto the bed, clambered on top of her, and satisfied himself. Got up, and Layton, confused, somewhat felt obliged to tell Jones that she was sorry. He replied, "Don't worry, my child, you needed it." Then Jones instructed her to stay where she was, and he'd ordered everybody else to get off the bus at the last rest stop so he could, and she could make her way out onto another bus unnoticed. Jones had sex with Debbie Layton a few more times, once in the People's Temple men's restroom, and never in any situation where Jones asked permission or Layton had time to think about it. Jones eventually promoted her to positions of greater temple responsibility, and she felt honored to be a part of the inner circle that included Carolyn Layton, Karen Layton, and now Terry Buford, Sharon Amos, and Tim Stone, and one or two others. Tim Stone was the attorney, I believe. But Jones had managed to keep his long-term affair with Carolyn Layton so closely guarded for a while that some of the women with whom he'd had liaisons with believed that they had replaced Marceline as father's new main bitch. In Terry Buford's words, "God's chick," they were soon disabused of their notion, and once they'd been taken by Jones, they no longer bothered to disguise his additional sex advances, or sexual activities, rather. Buford learned she wasn't Jones's only lover when she heard him loudly fucking another woman in the next room. But neither Buford nor any of the others ever caused a scene about it or accused him face-to-face of sex abuse or deception, and they never made public complaints about his actions to the wider People's Temple membership, fear recourse from management, so to speak. For some, it was because Jones's constant preaching about the bourgeois attitudes and selfishness made them feel guilty for even contemplating airing a personal grievance. Others realized that the bulk of Jones's followers would always align themselves with the father in any dispute, so leaving Jones and the church, leaving Jones and the church was rarely considered as an option. Jones always found some means to make his sex partners feel even more committed to the cause, often, as with Debbie Layton, by assigning them new, pseudo-important roles. His manipulative gifts were never more evident than with who he was fucking, and Jones himself never formed an emotional attachment to any of these women. They'd served a purpose, and that was sex, and sex was their reward. Jones even found a way to make his sex life rewarding to a devoted female follower that he didn't want. No one adored Jim Jones more than Patty Cartmell. She was ready to unquestioningly obey him and would have felt honored to serve Jones sexually, but she was disgustingly overweight, some would say rotund, and Jones' professed motivation to help raise women up by having sex with them did not apply to ones that were physically unattractive, conveniently. So when Jones' serial sexualizing reached near frantic proportions, there always seemed to be one more temple woman that he just had to have. He included Cartmell by putting her in charge of his, quote, quotation mark, fuck schedule, close quotes, which was a notebook listing Jones that scheduled, or a notebook listing who Jones was scheduled to fuck and when. Jesus Christ. Most, though not at all of the time, Jones confined himself to adults. There were winsome underage girls in the temple, and Jones had sex with at least one of them, who was a 14-year-old whose family found out and promptly left the temple, though without making the reason public out of respect for the cause. Jones sent emissaries to persuade them to return, but without success. Emissaries? What are you, fucking Xerxes? Jones also crossed another sexual line. A young man recently recruited to the temple and immediately raised to a position of considerable responsibility due to Jones' recognition of his organizational skills was stunned after one of the services when his new leader mentioned casually, "I'll fuck you in the ass if you want," and then he stammered, "No thanks." Jones grinned and said, "Well, if you ever want to, I can." Jones had occasional sex with male followers, never as often as he did with women, but on a regular basis, enough that young men leaders were warned by some of his previous male partners, "If you ask father to fuck you in the ass, take a douche." Whenever he discussed same-sex coupling with his inner temple circle, he insisted, I have to be all things to all people. And some male followers either needed to be sexually humbled or else encouraged to become more dedicated to the cause, and intercourse with Jones produced those results. He was pretty clearly a bisexual, even though he chose to not openly admit it, and for a long time he discouraged gay relationships among his followers, because it was only alright when he did it. Gary Lambriff, who made several abortive breaks with the temple, left for good after Jones refused to allow him even the possibility of having a long-term male partner. He said that if I had to have gay sex, I should go to some bar in San Francisco and get it done. I wanted something more than that, and Jim wouldn't allow it. As with women followers, Jones showed some restraint in the men he approached, and in those rare cases when he was turned down, did not insist. Most of his followers had no idea Jim Jones had numerous sex partners among temple members, but it was possible for Jones to keep his activities entirely secret from a growing member. The growing number of temple leaders that he kept promoting. He was openly challenged only once by Juan L. Smart, who was a young black woman married to a guy named David Wise, a white assistant temple minister, and she noticed a constant among Jones' conquests and confronted him. "Jim, why do you only sleep with whites and never with blacks?" Jones snapped back that the whites needed to be more dedicated to the cause and to its rejection of bourgeois attitudes. Sex with Jones helped them retain an appropriate socialist attitude, and blacks didn't have that problem, so there was no reason for him to fuck them. And on that note, just a brief word from one of our non-existent corporate overlord sponsors.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of Pointless Profanity. My name is Go Fuck Yourself, and on today's show, we'll be discussing shitting, pissing, and fucking. We'll also be taking a close look at cocks, cunts, and assholes later on in the show. Today's show is brought to you by your grandfather's balls, your whore of a sister, and sticky, smelly diarrhea. Stick around, you big bunch of spineless pussies, because when we come back from the break, we're going to sit down for an exclusive interview with a motherfucking son of a bitch bastard. Welcome to the show. From the makers of Rapist Glasses comes a new product that's sure to put the sex back into convicted sex criminal. Introducing Pedophile Beards. Pedophile Beards give you that creepy sex face that women simply can't resist. Stop going unnoticed with your boring nice guy look and start scaring the shit out of people. Pedophile Beards can be worn on their own or combined with our Rapist Glasses to create that rapist pedophile look that you've always wanted. And come by our store to check out some of our other products, like the Serial Killer Van, the Public Masturbator Trench Coat, the There's Gotta Be Something Wrong With That Guy hat, and our wide selection of pencil crayons. And remember, you don't have to be a convicted murderer slash public masturbating rapist pedophile to want to look like one. Sex criminal fashions, because the bad boy look is for pussies.
And of course, that was John LaJoy, somebody that has nothing to do with sponsoring or otherwise promoting this show. And speaking of fucking, right back at it. Sometimes in 1971, probably in March, Jones chose an unlikely new fuck partner. And in her first contact with him, a lady named Grace Stone disliked Jones as a person, though she strongly believed in his social missions. Tim Stone, if you remember him, in some ways was the most important member of People's Temple after Jones himself. Whatever Jones planned, sometimes plotted even, would be a more accurate term, Stones was responsible for keeping it within the law. He was the legal side of the People's Temple, if you be so inclined to call it that. This poor bastard. He was somebody that Jones could not afford to alienate, let alone lose or turn against him. However, Jim Jones made his way into Grace's bed all the same. Around the end of 1970, it became common knowledge within temple membership that not all was well between the Stones. Survivors remember Grace complaining about her husband's huge ego and his penchant for leaving her alone at home while he counseled Jones at odd hours of the night. And at some point, she mentioned that she and Tim had not been intimate for fucking months. Jones made it his business to know every bit of personal gossip about his followers, so he knew about this as well. He had his followers fill out information cards on prospective members, and they were constantly updated. And so were cards about current members. He had files on fucking everybody. He was like the Clintons. As soon as Grace Stone began grumbling about her husband, old Jimba knew about it. Jim Jones Jr. thinks his father always lusted after Grace, who, like Karen Layton, was extremely hot. He wanted to get in her pants, it's that simple. Even so, Jones had to recognize the risk that was involved. Tim Stone was not a bitch like Larry Layton, and it was bad enough if the man he relied on for expert legal advice left the temple, and it would be worse because next to Jones himself, Tim Stone knew everything. Jones, his natural paranoia, exaggerated by his excessive drug use, was haunted by the belief that the FBI and CIA were eager for potentially incriminating info about the temple and its leader. And Tim Stone, seeking revenge on Jones for cuckolding him, essentially, would have plenty of shit to talk. But Jones felt that he had the measure, or that he had the measure of the man. Tim Stone was a passionate believer, if not in Jim Jones himself, but in God. Then at least in the temple, just as an institution, he had belief in that too. Stone could have made a fortune in a private practice or as a partner in some just benevolent or venerable San Francisco law firm, and he gave up not only personal wealth but professional prestige to hold down a staff job in the district attorney's office in an isolated California county. His marriage was in trouble, at least in part because of his devotion to temple obligations. Yet Stone obviously believed that helping Jim Jones lead the way to a better world was worth the sacrifice. Another Jones trait was also in play, and that was it was important to Jones that everybody else in temple leadership demonstrate subservience to him. A special few were allowed more leeway than others. Jack Beam sometimes told less than worshipful stories about Father in the old days, and on occasion gently mocked Jones to his face. Archie James cautioned Jones when he thought the temple leader talked too much or too bluntly. Marceline was allowed to question some of his decisions, and Carolyn Layton had personal expectations of him that he allowed, though he was not that they weren't always met. Still, though, they acknowledged his supremacy. They might make suggestions, plead, or even argue, but they ultimately obeyed him because they were all pushover cunts. Jones' relationship with Tim Stone, however, was different because of the legal precedent that he possessed and Jones did not. Jones needed to treat Stone almost as an equal. Ever since Stone had joined People's Temple, Jones had no means of reminding him of his proper place in the temple hierarchy, which might be above all the other members, but still beneath Jim Jones, because Jim Jones was God. So then came an opportunity with Grace, who was unhappy with her husband, and had his permission to engage in sex with somebody else. Stone wrote in his memoir, Marked for Death, that he adopted an open marriage policy with Grace and took advantage of it himself with many a single lonely woman with children that didn't have a man at home. And if at some point Grace wanted to stray, I did not want to be a hypocrite. And sometimes during late March or April 1971, Grace Stone became pregnant with the bastard child of Jimba Jones, a.k.a. Tiny Dick Jones, a.k.a. Micropenis Jones Esquire. And so far as anyone was aware, things were fine with Jones's immediate family and with Marceline. Marceline Jones played an integral role still in the temple, helping to organize outreach programs, leading services, and taking care of pretty much everything when her husband was away from the valley, standing nearby when Jones was at the pulpit and coming forward sometimes to assist him in certain ways. Her public posture towards her husband never varied. Laura Cole remembers that Marceline seemed like she was just mesmerized by old Jim. She would give him that adoring, "I've never had a job in my life," Nancy Reagan look. Just say no. Just say no. Fuck you. Fuck you, Nancy Reagan. The Jones children appeared to be thriving, and Agnes remained frequently estranged, but Suzanne had grown into an attractive, self-assured young woman. And Stephen, Lou, and Jimmy were generally boisterous, typical teen boys, and the fourth son had just been added. Tim Tipper was the son of a temple member who was about Stephen's age and had attached himself to the family. Although Jones and Marceline wouldn't formally adopt him for a few more years, he'd already been accepted as a full-fledged family member. There were perks that all of them enjoyed, though he kept the excursions from most of the temple membership because Jones believed in family vacations, but they were expensive. So he took his brood to every World's Fair, and they made pretty regular trips to Hawaii. A couple of sons accompanied them, or accompanied their dad on a jaunt to Germany, and these getaways were always great times, awkward only in the sense that if any lasted 2 weeks, Jones had Marceline along for 1 week and Carolyn for another. That's pretty awkward. The Jones kids had horses and a variety of pets. Besides dogs, there was a chimp named Mr. Muggs who accompanied, or who occupied a cage just outside their house in Redwood Valley. The temple members were told that Jones had saved Mr. Muggs from death in laboratory experiments, though some later came to believe the chimp was purchased by Jones from a pet store. He was. Jim Jones Jr. remembers. I think Steven somehow saw Mr. Muggs, and we got him instead of the ocelot that I was supposed to get for my birthday. The chimp then became the unofficial temple mascot. Poor taste. Other temple youngsters learned that it was a good idea to be friends with the Jones boys because then you got to do more. The Jones gang of brothers and their pals were allowed to go to the movies and wore spiffy sports gear, and some resentment grew amongst the general temple members because of such favoritism, and that had no place in a socialist society. And they were right. When the rest of the temple kids and teens were expected to live just as impoverished as their parents, the Jones boys did not. Carolyn Layton felt compelled to issue a statement. The Jones offspring needed extra privileges due to the constant pressure they felt because of outside threats to their father, and it was true that the Jones daughters and sons were under constant, sometimes emotionally crippling pressure, not from outside threats, however, but from their father and his erratic, at best, behavior. And forcing Carolyn on his children was one of the main issues. Jones insisted that they treat her with the same respect as Marceline, but they wouldn't. Although Carolyn wrote a rapturous note to her parents claiming the children love me like a second mother, Stephen felt no such warmth, and Carolyn's relationship with Stephen couldn't have been as close as she claimed because she didn't even spell his fucking name right, identifying him as Stephen with a V instead of a PH in her letter to the Moores. Lou and Jimmy, both in many ways closer to their father than to Marceline, tolerated Carolyn at best, but all the children sympathized to some degree, at least with their mother, and never considered Carolyn any type of maternal replacement. Tension caused by what Stephen termed a forced family was constant and overbearing. Not to mention, Jones' additional sexual activities didn't affect his children for a long time because they didn't know about him, but his drug use had a particularly profound effect on the young Joneses, who soon realized that rather than laying down and meditating, their father was instead passed out from self-medicating, not meditating. They were constantly aware of pill bottles and medicine cabinets and trays of white liquid in the refrigerator, and once found him face down in front of the hall. When I was drinking and I had a roommate, I remember that what I described as taking a nice nap was described by my roommate's girlfriend, who'd come over, as being passed out on the floor. I took a nap after work, and she said to him that I was passed out drunk on the floor. Ha. Ha. I was not. Maybe I was. Doesn't matter. And now a message from another corporate overlord that I do not have.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of Pointless Profanity. My name is Go Fuck Yourself, and on today's show we'll be putting aside cocks, cunts, and assholes to dive into the world of stab wound fucking, muff slapping, and incestuous homosexual intercourse. We'll also be attempting to answer the questions, should we be paying more or less for menstruating prostitutes? And how many gallons of horse semen can be pumped into a human asshole? But first, it's time to open up the mailbag and read the letter of the week. Joey from New Hampshire writes, "Dear fucker, what the fuck, man? Your show fucking sucks, bitch." Well, Joey, thanks for the constructive criticism. Unfortunately, we all know that you have a baby-sized penis, and the last time you had sex was in 1994 with a one-armed hooker named Steve. So your life sucks definitely more than my show does. Thanks for the letter. Stick around, you big bunch of dick-loving cum-swappers, because after the break, I'm going to soak my arm in kerosene, light it, then fist-fuck a goat.
And we're back. The Other children mostly compartmentalized, and Jim Jr. said that he had no idea the extent of his father's drug use until years later in Guyana, but Stephen was more sensitive to it. He'd suffered for some time from his own illness, which was a congenital narrowing of the urethra that required surgery and a catheter. Jones explained that he could not use his own healing powers to banish his dick ailment because the suffering through the affliction would help Stephen grow as a leader. Wow. The youngster was pleased that Jones and Marceline both spent time with him at the hospital because it looked like they were a family again and like everything might be okay, but he was fucking wrong. Stephen Jones was 12 when he swallowed 14 Quaaludes from a bottle on his dad's dresser, hoping to seem sick enough afterwards to be allowed to skip at least some of the Wednesday night temple meeting. Marceline, who was a trained nurse, thankfully saved his life, rushing him to the Ukiah General Hospital where he received emergency treatment. She and Jones had to subsequently endure a hospital meeting with a psychiatric staff that was a condition of Stephen's release. The boy deliberately took heavy Quaalude doses twice more, leaving suicide notes both times. In an essay written decades later, he mused that he didn't intend to actually kill himself, just get more attention. Once he had to be taken to the hospital again, this time the one in San Francisco, because Jones didn't want to risk any more local gossip. Stephen remembers that on the drive, his brothers took turns slapping him with a little too much verve to keep him awake. After the first incident, and even after the second and third, Jim Jones still left his fucking pills and liquid drugs in places where they were easy for anybody to find. Marceline always thought that in spite of his flaws as a husband, he was at least a good father. Now he was willing to endanger his children because he wanted his drugs conveniently stashed. That would be the point to quit using drugs, I think. 2 years after her husband had taken up with Carolyn Moore, Marceline still held some hope that he would tire of the other women, and meanwhile, Marceline had her children and her rewarding job with the state and a continuing role in People's Temple. If no longer her husband's primary advisor, it was hard, but she manned up, so to speak. When Marceline's younger sister Sharon divorced, Marceline made the mistake of inviting her to move with her kids to the Redwood Valley. It would have been a comfort for Marceline to have a sister so near, and Sharon made a visit, but after hearing her brother-in-law preach about his godly powers, had no desire to be around him. Marceline stayed in her own difficult marriage, perhaps thinking that Carolyn Moore and the drugs, that it couldn't possibly get any worse, so she was just going to ride it out because she'd already tolerated the worst. Ha! It did indeed get worse, however. And for a short time, Marceline may have not have been aware of Jones' increased sexual proclivity with other temple members besides Carolyn. Everyone in the temple loved her, and even the women sleeping with her husband. They're all fucking whores. Nobody dropped cruel hints, hoping to enjoy her dismay. And certainly, in the 2 years since Carolyn had been sharing Jones' bed, Marceline had learned to ignore clues that might cause her additional pain. She had enough problems already. Then, on January 25th, 72, John Victor Stone was born in Santa Rosa Hospital. The healthy infant's birth certificate listed his mother as 21-year-old Grace Stone and 34-year-old Timothy Stone, and under California law that established the two as John's legal parents. But on February 6th, 1972, Tim Stone signed a humiliating statement addressed to whom it may concern. I, Timothy Oliver Stone, hereby acknowledge that on April 1971, I entreated my beloved pastor, James W. Jones, to sire a child by my wife, Grace Lucy Stone, who had previously, at my insistence, reluctantly but graciously consented thereto. James W. Jones agreed to do so reluctantly after I explained that I very much wished to raise a child, but I was unable, after extensive attempts to sire one myself. My reason for requesting James W. Jones do this is that I wanted my child to be fathered, if not by me, by the most compassionate and honest, courageous human being the world contains. The child, John Victor Stone, was born on January 25th, 1972, and I am privileged beyond words to have the responsibility for caring for him and undertake his task humbly, with the steadfast hope that the child will become a devoted follower of Jesus Christ and be instrumental in bringing God's kingdom here on earth, as has been his wonderful natural father. I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct. Jesus fucking Christ. In his memoir, Stone said that as a lawyer, he believed the statement, which was not an official affidavit, had no legal effect, and it could not constitute perjury and could never be used against him in court. Everything about the declaration was a lie, except that Stone had chosen to believe that Jones was, in fact, John Victor's father. If he had any doubt or any hope, it wasn't true. In 1972, there was no scientific means to prove or disprove paternity. The HLA test, which compared the HLA levels in a child's blood to the putative father, it didn't necessarily rule out paternity, but it could make a pretty educated guess. There was also a blood type matching test. A child with type O blood could have been sired by a father with type AB blood, but DNA testing was still a decade away, so there was no way to know. Jones, Stone wrote, came to him a week before the child's birth to inform the stunned attorney that he was John Victor's father. By Stone's account, his belief in Jones was so strong that he could not fathom a good person saying such a thing if it wasn't true. So to reassure Jones that he would never seek to take the child from him, Stone signed the inordinary eulistic statement, whose only possible purpose was to cause me maximum embarrassment in the highly unlikely event of me ever trying to deprive Jones of John Victor. Jones didn't demand that the child be turned over to him immediately. John Victor would remain in Stone and Grace's care, but he now had the signed statement from Stone with all its humiliating overtones. Even if requesting it was substantially motivated by Stone's own love for the baby and fear that he might somehow be denied contact with him, another factor was certainly at play. Tim Stone was acknowledging that Jim Jones fucked his wife and got her pregnant, and the humiliation was deliberate. The statement could have been worded in a much nicer way to Stone, but Jones intended to document to humble Stone and also somebody else. There was a line at the bottom of the statement for a signature of a witness, and there were plenty of available Jones loyalists that would have gladly served the role, but Jones had somebody else specifically in mind. It was another person besides Stone he believed needed reminding of her proper subservient place on the witness line. And on the witness line, written in painfully neat cursive, appeared the signature of Marceline M. Jones. Her mood when she signed it cannot be determined, but her actions in the months immediately afterwards proved that she had reached her end of her patience with Jones, and she told somebody that if she could be any animal, it would be a turtle, so she could crawl back into her shell and die. Oof. Marceline found herself a new shell of sorts when she rented an apartment in Santa Rosa, about 60 miles south of the Redwood Valley. Previously, she'd often spent a few weeknights away from home. Well, her state job inspecting healthcare facilities required some travel, but now she was home only on the weekends when she obediently carried out her temple duties. Standing in for Jones when he was out of town and playing supporting roles during the services if he wasn't. During those public moments, her demeanor remained substantially the same, respectful of her husband, supportive of the temple and the existing program still. There was a sense that she became emotionally detached. New members felt that Marceline was hard to get to know, and veteran temple members noticed that she was far less active in developing new outreach programs. Marceline's children, already used to both parents' frequent absences, a full-time housekeeper named Esther prepared meals and kept a watchful eye on the Jones horde. She didn't notice much of a difference. We lived in a little bubble, and it was usually good, Jim Jones Jr. remembers, so far as they knew, the mom-dad-Carolyn combination was still going on, and if for a time they were seeing their mother less, it was because she was still a strong presence in their lives, but Marceline was using the space she created away from Redwood Valley to look at the possibility of a future for herself and her children without Jimba. She remained an attractive woman, intelligent and capable on her own. Jim Jones boasted to his male temple friends of his sexual magnetism and how women found him irresistible, and he forgot that Marceline had her own appeal. Then came the reminder. Sometime after the birth of John Victor, Marceline returned to her home near Temple Church in Redwood Valley and informed her husband she was leaving him. She'd fallen in love with a psychologist she'd met through her work for the state. Marceline planned to divorce Jones, marry the new man who lived in Fort Benning, Georgia, and take the children with her. Attagirl Marceline, perhaps she hoped that Jones would beg her to stay, or at least admit that his own selfish actions had irrevocably ruined their marriage. And instead, Jones summoned the children to join him and Marceline immediately in an impromptu family meeting. Jones took the offensive, saying, "Mom wants to break up the family." He declared that she was being selfish, putting her own desires ahead of what was best for everybody. And this man, this doctor, whoever he was, wanted to take Mom and them to Fort Benning, Georgia, away from all the things that they had in the Redwood Valley, away from the horses and the pets and their friends and all the fun. Revealing his parental sense of chauvinism, Suzanne was a girl, so her opinion didn't matter. Jones demanded of Lou, Stephen, and Jimmy, "Do you want to go with your mother?" All three said, "We want to stay with you, Dad," choosing the familiar over the unknown. Jones felt that he won. Then Marceline said she would leave, marry the psychologist, and take the children anyway. In front of their children, Jones thundered that if Marceline tried to take them, you will be met by the Avengers of Death. And Marceline Jones knew her husband well, including how he fabricated demonstrations of superpowers. And a threat to summon Avengers of Death might have caused the gullible temple members to quail, but she knew better. But then Jones switched to more basic terms, and if you ever take my boys away, you'll be dead. He now had armed bodyguards who were fanatical in their worship of him and undoubtedly willing to kill on command. So Marceline took this threat pretty seriously, since she backed down. Jones dismissed the family meeting, and Marceline reassumed her secondary place in the temple, and as it expanded, was required to stand in for Jones much more often, adding to the ongoing demands of her state job. There was no time or opportunity left to continue one outside romance or to try to pursue another, and Steve had said decades later that I think Mom did the best she could do with what she had because it was all she could do. There were a lot of things that kept her there, love of her children, as well as a sense of responsibility to Jones's followers, who she believed were good people, genuinely trying to change the world for the better. But after the family meeting, there was also the possibility that Marceline's own life was at stake. Better than anybody, she understood Jones' ruthlessness. So she stayed, and it cost her dearly. Jim Jones Jr. recalls, "Of course, Mom wasn't happy after that. More than ever, she became a sad woman. Not that she'd ever been happy, really, but far more noticeable. And for the Jones sons, life went on much the same. However, it was different for Suzanne. A few years earlier, she dated a guy named Mike Cartmell, the teenage son of Patty Cartmell, and who helped run the temple youth activities. Cartmell, to Jones's mind, was the perfect husband for Suzanne. He was the child of perhaps Jones's ultimate loyalist, and he'd demonstrated his own dedication for years and was strikingly intelligent, apparently heading for a career in law." Not law enforcement, I would imagine, more legal side of things. At one point, Jones told Mike, "I'd love to adopt you and would, but for Suzanne, I will not. Then you couldn't marry her." So far as Jones was concerned, Suzanne would marry whoever her father wanted. But she was strong-minded. She dated Cartmell for a while, and they were both in high school. He was a senior, and she was a freshman. But it was the younger one who broke shit off. Cartmell despaired. He was enthralled with Suzanne's assertive personality and her blossoming good looks, but Jones didn't give up. He spent the next few years constantly telling his daughter about the latest things that Mike had done, and Jones went so far to tell Cartmell that he was Jones' chosen successor, making it logical that Cartmell and Suzanne would marry to keep the next generation of temple leadership entirely within the Jones family. It was a ploy, though. Privately, Jones had already designated that in the event of his death, Marceline would lead the church until such time as Stephen was ready to assume the helm. But Jones never let facts interfere with the truth, or with his convenient promises. Suzanne relented and began dating Cartmell again, and they eventually married in 73. Afterwards, Cartmell noticed a change to Marceline's attitude towards him. Previously, she'd been friendly. Now she snapped at him almost every time they were together, finding fault with whatever he said or did. He complained to Jones, who replied, "Son, you've just got Marceline on your ass, and I don't envy you." For a long time, Cartmell couldn't figure out why, but finally he felt that he understood. Marceline Jones, swept into marriage with the leader of the People's Temple, and then betrayed by him, was furious that Jones had maneuvered their daughter into the same potential fate. And on that note, we are out of time. But I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning back in. It's always a pleasure to see the stats slowly climbing or staying consistent. There has been a pretty consistent show of people showing support and emailing me on Instagram, which I know is a pain in the ass, but fortunately for you guys, if you would like to reach out, which I would love to hear from you, you now can do so at my convenient email address, which is springheeljack@anthologyofhorror.com. Once again, that is springheeljack@anthologyofhorror.com. Because I am a grown-up and a consummate professional, so please do not hesitate to reach out, as I would love to hear your opinions, your suggestions, and your questions, comments, hate mail, or concern. As for the most influential listeners or subscribers from last week, please allow me to get up my map and tell you I have been very impressed with the spreading. It's my very own people's temple. I'm just kidding, I don't actually believe that. But it's very nice to see that you guys are telling people and that the people you're telling are enjoying it. And I can't see that because it's spreading and it's a web effect. Just be patient with me, I am almost there. Okay, so as far as the last episode goes, drumroll. All right. The most influential member for the last episode, and that was the Book of Not Fucking. That is the City of London, number one. Followed by Portland, Oregon. Followed by Erie, Pennsylvania. Followed by Orlando, Florida. Followed by Los Angeles, California. Tied with Denver, Colorado. Tied with Rhode Island. Tied with Littleton, Colorado. And then followed by Mount Joy, Pennsylvania, which dropped off quite a bit from last week. And then Mount Joy is tied with Tahunga. Thank you very much, guys. It's always nice to see new cities on that list. I genuinely appreciate each and every one of you. I see that I lost Belfast when I started ripping on the Catholic Church. Anyway, thank you all very much. I will most likely release another anecdotal-type episode today on the second part and conclusion of the Book of Not Fucking. But as always, it is a joy to see that you guys are tuning back in, and it will continue to help the spread of the podcast and the longevity of it if you tell your friends, tell your family that you enjoy the podcast and what it is we talk about, so that way my ego continues to be stroked and I continue to churn out new episodes. Thank you very much. Look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. But in the meantime, stay spooky.